Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We got an exciting episode today to talk about. Super excited about today's topic. I got my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our payment integrity director. And so, of course, we're going to talk today about EFT fraud. Electronic funds transfer fraud. There was a recent OIG fraud alert that was out there and a recent study that was done by the OIG on this. This is an interesting one. A lot of people that are in this space aren't inordinately familiar with this. I want to share my screen briefly just so that everybody can see this. But there's this recent fraud alert that came out just about a week or two ago. For those of you that don't know these kind of studies, so this particular study, which was released in March of 2025, just last week, it's from OE&I, so Office of Evaluation and Inspections. And without getting too granular, there's three or four main components at OIG. There's four main components. Office of Evaluation and Inspection, they do kind of empirical analyses on weaknesses in the program. Office of Audit Services, which do audits of different program aspects with respect to payment. Office of Investigations, where Wade, Matt, and I came from, where the badge and guns. And then Office of Counsel to the Inspector General. They do things like provide advisory opinions and do what are known as CMPL cases, civil monetary penalty law cases. And so one of the things that OE&I did here was they did a study, and again, these studies that are done, and by the way, the OIG and its collective, its job is to ferret out and identify fraud, waste, and abuse within the program. That's the mission of all OIGs, and each year, OIGs put out a list of unimplemented recommendations. HHS OIG puts out a top 10 list every year. It typically amounts to potentially billions of dollars in savings. I saw a study recently that showed that if you took all of the OIG unimplemented studies across OIGs for I forget how many years, it was something like $98 billion in savings. And those are unimplemented programs. So you have to go and take a look at those. They're kind of interesting. This one is an interesting one because we worked on a case involving this a few years ago, and it's still going on. I do suggest a quick, this is a one pager. And when you look at these one pagers, the one pagers are kind of short and to the point, and then they will give you within the website for it or the link for it, they'll give you the full study, why they did it, all of that. So essentially what happens is a group of criminals, maybe it's one, maybe it's a team, somehow through social engineering, hacking, deep web, Silk Road, any of that kind of stuff, these nefarious actors go and they get the information relative to the contractual agreement between a provider of services and a payer. This can be in the commercial space, in the Medicare space, in the Medicaid space. And what they're doing is they're then going in and they're doing what's called an EFT change form, electronic fund transfer form. And that's exactly what it sounds like. EFT is the agreement that the provider has with the payer to get money. No one gives paper checks anymore. The Medicare program no longer does paper checks and hasn't done it in a long time. Medicaid, commercial payers, you have to have an electronic transfer so that that money can be tracked from beginning to end. It also speeds up the payment process, right? You don't have to wait for a check to be cut, to be mailed, to be received. You don't have to worry about it getting stolen in the mail, getting destroyed, any of that. And so in the normal course of business, providers submit their claims. The claim gets processed, and through that EFT agreement, the financial portion of it goes into the bank account, and the provider then goes and does their reconciliation for what's known as accounts receivable. In the provider space, they typically will call this RCM, revenue cycle management. It's understanding where your money's coming from, where it's going, and all of those things. Where the nefarious part comes in is that providers that have these agreements, someone will steal information. It could be an identity theft. It could be, you know, one of the connected things to it. And they complete an EFT change form, send it to the payer, and then the money gets rerouted to the bad guy's account. And it can take a while until that gets caught. We worked on a project a couple of years ago where one of our Medicaid clients discovered about $500,000 in these payments. The way that they discovered it was their in-network provider went into the portal and saw that about $500,000 in monies had been paid, but they didn't have the money. The portal showed it as being paid, but the money had been diverted. So they reached out to the payer. The payer said, we have a problem. They then, you know, got us involved, and we helped to facilitate making a referral over to the my old regional office, the New York OIG office, because it was a New York plan. And it turned out that OIG was already working on a whole bunch of these cases, including some other collateral cases that have very similar fact patterns to the one that we referred to. So, you know, there's a lot of steps in this. But Wade, you know, I want to start with you, because the one thing that we hear a lot from our partners in the SIU world, a lot of the training that we do, we always get asked whenever we're talking about what topics would our clients like to see, one of the topics is always financial investigations. And the one thing that we always have to try to explain to our SIU clients is that financial investigations in the non-government space are really a challenge because of the Bank Secrecy Act, Privacy Acts, all of these things that come into play, state banking laws, all of these things create really big challenges for non-law enforcement because we don't have subpoena authority and we don't have the ability to do that. This is unique because most of the information that would be needed to ultimately make a referral to law enforcement, but also the ability to kind of look behind that curtain is information that we potentially have, right? So this is one of those unique ones where you can actually do a pretty fulsome investigation without having, up to the point of maybe knowing who the bad guys are, but certainly being able to understand a lot of the backing pieces of that.
Right. There's some systems that I know some SIUs have access to and some don't, but like the Pecos system, which is a provider enrollment chain, and ownership system, I think the acronym is. So that's one of the tools that if the SIU has access, you can go in and look at the change of ownership, you know, when it was implemented, you know, the old information, the old identifying information, the new information. So it's a good start to try and find out how this EFT change happened.
And just interrupt you, Wade. So there may be an instance, though, where someone has not done anything in Pecos fraudulently. They've just done the change for the EFT just for banking. There may be an instance where they're doing both, but these two are not necessarily, they could be mutually exclusive, right?
Right. Yeah. And you made the point that's, I think, the key point here is the SIUs are really limited, not only just by not having subpoena power and certain banking regulations that would exclude information from being shared with an SIU investigator as opposed to an OIG agent. A lot of times it's hard enough to get the information with a subpoena or with the OIG access letter. It's still hard to get that information, but if you're calling from, you know, whatever the name of the SIU is, you're really going to have a rough time getting cooperation and information from like a banking internal investigations office. So that's one of the areas where, you know, a lot of times the SIU has to decide, is this a fraud case that we're going to work? Is it something that we think is fraudulent where we're going to refer it to law enforcement? And this is one case where you can do the preliminary research, like you were saying, but this is one that I think just because of the limitations is a prime candidate for being referred to law enforcement because the SIUs are set up to address the fraudulent claims. So it's a claim that was upcoded, not provided, whatever it is. But in this case, although it's still fraud, it's very different from traditional healthcare fraud. It's really just a payment fraud, which you could work into like a 1340s, like a healthcare fraud statute because it's a scheme or device to defraud, but it's really not the provider. You could argue back and forth who's really the victim here. It's the provider didn't get their money, but the payer paid out on legitimate claims that they determined to be payable. So there's a bunch of different issues there, but this is one case where I really think it does have to go at least have law enforcement involvement, and that way the SIU can be kind of the bridge between law enforcement and the payer who maybe normally wouldn't have information or have access to information regarding this type of an investigation.
Yeah, and what makes these interesting, financial investigations are always, as someone who's not an accountant, really, I have a hard enough time balancing my checkbook. I usually, if I took money out of the ATM, I go, okay, that doesn't, that was how I balanced my checkbook back in the day. But, what makes these interesting cases is, at least from the SIU perspective, is you can really get pretty close to a complete investigation minus knowing who the bad actors are, right? So you get this EFT document, whether it be electronic, fax, whatever it may be. You can look and see, okay, what's the new bank account? What's the routing number? What's the account number? What's the bank name? And go into your payment processing system. You probably, as an SIU person, have to get somebody from another department to help you, but you could potentially do some searching and find out, is this one particular provider the only provider that this has happened to, or are we talking about potentially other providers that just haven't caught on yet? Right. And obviously the larger your network of providers is, the broader the swath is, right? So your national providers of payers are going to potentially have the ability to find, maybe this is happening in different parts of the country with providers where they've obtained a lot of this. But the thing that you've brought up, which is the interesting piece also, is bridging that relationship that the SIU might not typically get involved with the department that just pays the claims, the finance department. And so this is one of those instances where the SIU, and there are SIUs out there, by the way, who have an internal investigative team, because even on the payer side, people that work at the payers are doing things like maybe fraudulently submitting reimbursements for expenses, things of that sort. So it is not uncommon for some of the larger payers to have an internal investigations team. And those people are typically not working your traditional healthcare fraud cases. They're working financial type cases from the inside. Is someone trying to expense gas or a hotel or something like that? And, maybe you have to get somebody like that involved. But there's certainly that ability to help to bridge that gap in the knowledge base. Someone might come and say, hey, SIU, why are you reaching out to me for this? Versus, some other departments. So this is like another example where that actually works. And in the bigger plans, you probably have the ability to work to bridge that gap with a little bit more oomph to it, because you're going to have someone, if there's enough of these cases that come in, or at least the ability to monitor it. So, but did you ever work on any of these? I mean, obviously from the financial perspective, when we're looking at bank records and kickbacks and all of that stuff, normally your normal financial cases that we're looking at in the healthcare fraud world require just a lot of heads down time. This one, it's really more of sitting at your laptop and looking at things like Pecos and looking at some financial transactions. And you can certainly look to package some of these up. I think these would be interesting cases, right? Did you ever work on anything like this?
I didn't work any that were electronic fund transfer related, but in the kind of the precursor to that, when they were issuing paper checks, I worked money laundering cases where they got checks that were fraudulently paid out to identity theft victim physicians.
Right.
And then the clinic administrators or the clinic owners who were really behind the fraud had to find ways to launder these checks. They had checks for, $50,000, $75,000 and dozens of them. We talked about this case in the past, but dozens of checks that they need to turn into cash to launder.
Right.
So it wasn't so much the EFT. This is like the new updated version. Back then you needed somebody like on the inside at a bank who's willing to take these checks and turn them into cash and return the cash to you.
So, this is, we did a long time ago, you and I, we did a retro fraud where we talked about what's old is new and the circus doesn't change. It's just the clowns. This is the modern version of that, right? The one thing that I think I would suggest is similarly to when The SIU sends a medical record request out to a provider, and you have that provider sign an attestation. This is one of those where if the provider is claiming that they didn't get their check, that they have to do an attestation. I know that when we work these kinds of cases on the Medicare side, when I was at OIG, there was an attestation that was required by the MAC or by CMS or whoever it was at the time from the provider, because the provider would say, I never got my check, and the check would have to get pulled from the bank and all of that. But in the meantime, there was that CMS affidavit of loss to get a check reissued, and then you'd have to get in touch with the bank and then get the check and all of that stuff. And it was a very arduous process. Now with electronic stuff, it's not, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be getting an attestation to make sure, is the provider trying to get a double payment out of you? Are they doing basically a double billing without actually double billing? But, you know, it's an interesting piece. So Matt, you know, the thing that kind of begs the question is, this is such an obscenely simple fraud scheme. And so And by simple fraud scheme, I mean, getting the information may not be simple, or maybe it is. I've never been into the, you know, Silk Road dark web to get this information, but you're able to get it. It's not that hard. You just need a certain kind of browser that you can download. So you can use Google or one of those search engines to download the browser for the dark web. You get onto the dark web and you can buy all of this information. So once you've got it, it's a matter of just getting in and doing what you need to do. But it certainly begs the question that in today's electronic world, you know, there's got to be stopgaps in place. It shouldn't just be that simple. I mean, I can't make a purchase online without having to do 3 and 4 levels of authentication requiring my phone, a thumbprint, an iris scan, a urine sample. I mean, it's just the level of encryption that's needed. Dual authentication, triple authentication is unbelievable. And the fact that in some instances it doesn't exist. Now, I know that the OIG study showed that something like in their study, 2/3 of the payers out there had something to help to stop this. But that means that, you know, like anything else, 1/3 didn't. There's stuff out there. Like this is a fraud that should almost never occur or should be a rare occurrence.
Yes, it's absolutely preventable and easily preventable. As you said, you know, in the market, you know, you try to change your address with, you know, Amazon Prime, they're going to be sending you a code that you have to put in within 30 seconds or 30 minutes, or that change is not going to take effect. That same type of mechanism needs to be in place here, where the providers or the plan has a dual verification process in place as part of their compliance plan. They get one of these change of EFT requests through a fax or an email, whatever it may be. They should have in place a process where they're contacting a known person within that provider to say, did you do this? And please validate that you did somehow, whether it's what is the new EFT and make sure it matches or whatever, so that before you make the change in the system, you know that it actually comes from the provider that was, you know, that's purportedly requesting that change. But as the OIG shows, and as these instances that you guys talked about, it's not happening. And I think a lot of it has to do with what's always the number one priority of CMS and a lot of these plans: making sure the providers get their money quickly. So that priority might take precedence over the security to make sure that the provider actually is getting their money.
Right.
And that's, it's just easily preventable. And it's in what Wade talked about was, you know, gathering that information. You know, you've got to get that information to law enforcement as soon as possible, because again, that might be only one victim of many. That money's going to be going out quickly. Nothing's stopping that money from traveling to that new EFT address. And so these losses can mount up very, very quickly. And if they're hitting one provider, they're probably hitting more than one. And it's probably those providers that are large enough that the loss of funds might not be recognizable or identified right at first. But it's going to take time to where it got to $500,000 for that one entity. You know, if you hit a large hospital chain, might never get noticed, you know, for 6 months. And there's, you know, then there's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. You know, the challenge is to catch it quickly, to stop it before it really happens. And I think, you know, the simplest thing is when an EFT comes in, a change, and it's for something entirely different or not entirely different, but any EFT change that comes in, claims have got to be stopped immediately. There has to be a vetting process. Right. And that vetting process has to be done, a phone call to a known point of contact, and maybe even some information where that known point of contact has to be able to say, our last EFT was for this amount of money, right? Because the bad guys are not going to necessarily know, right? I mean, I know when I call my bank for something, sometimes their challenge questions will be, tell me the last three deposits into your account. Tell me the value of the last check and the check number that you wrote. Something that you can only know because you have that information readily available. The bad guys put in that EFT change. They don't know what happened before. They only know what's happening after. Right. And so there are some challenges that can come in with, you know, ensuring that you're only dealing with one or two points of contact. These things should not be done via email. If a change comes in, you should not be reaching out via email, because if your information has been hacked, it's very possible that there's, you know, that there's keystroke hacking going on and that your email has been hacked. And whatever email is going to you is also going to the bad guy, you know, in some sort of a parallel fashion. So you can't do that. You've got to have a phone call to specific people that are points of contact, and there have to be some ways to do challenges. And those challenges have to be very, very specific to things that only maybe the point of contact would know. And obviously in something like a hospital situation, it's going to be a little bit more of a challenge because the person that's your point of contact might not know what was the value of the last EFT or when was the last EFT done or something. But someone should be in the position of being able to get that information through the billing department or something like that. You know, obviously this is something that's been going on for a number of years. I think the project that we worked on here was about maybe 3 years ago. OIG is still obviously seeing these cases come in. I think this study was done. There was a fraud alert put out about a year ago about it. I just talked to some people at the OIG. They're still working on these cases because on the Medicare side, these go to the MAC, the Medicare Administrative Contractors, for processing. I know that with the one plan that we had that had this issue, one of their weaknesses was that there was a third party entity that was the credentialing organization, and the EFTs went to them. And so they just processed it without any dual authentication. We got them to stop that, and we got them to pull anything with EFT was in-house and required two or three layers of things that we recommended, including nothing on email, all telephone. And it might not be a bad idea to also do it through written correspondence to that point of contact specifically at an address that's known, right, where there's information that's already there. And that's, wait, I think this is where you get back to the Pecos. If you've got somebody who's in Pecos and it's Dr. Matt Kachansky at this address and there hasn't been a change, there's nothing fraudulent about it, it hasn't been flagged, the information that you had is the information you have. And that's where your written correspondence goes. And any claims are going to be held in abeyance until they've been resolved because of a potential fraud, waste, abuse issue. So I think it's an interesting thing because this is a 100% preventable fraud. There's a lot of stuff out there in the billing and coding world where people say this is preventable. This doesn't need to happen. We can stop this. That may be true. It may not be true. This is something in which you could absolutely stop every fraudulent penny on a fraudulent EFT from going out. And there shouldn't even be an argument about we can't stop it. There's ways to put things in place because it really comes down to what ultimately is a human error or the lack of an electronic flag to stop it, to then let humans come in. So if you have a person physically typing in that information, that's your human error right there, that there's no one stopping it. And if it's an electronic system, that there isn't a flag to then alert a human to get involved. This is, again, human intelligence is an important factor in these things. So for those of you in the SIU space and you get these cases, work them because they're great cases to work. You've got most of that information. And when you do see these, get your law enforcement partners involved quickly, because you want to be able to stop that money flow quickly and identify who the bad guys are before that money totally disappears. And just from the payment perspective, what are the flags to stop it? What are the not red flags? What are the flaggings to stop this from happening? And how do you have internal controls to stop this from happening? So this can absolutely be preventable. It's a great topic. I'd love to hear what plans you're doing. I'd love to hear if any plans have had this happen. So drop us a note. Reach out to us on our website, advise@advizehealth.com. Let us know. Again, we love the topics. I just got an email the other day on some topics that we're going to be presenting in the next couple of weeks. Again, our newsletter every Friday comes to you. We got a bunch of LinkedIn Lives coming up, and just content. We try to do as much content as possible. So we appreciate everybody taking their time. Appreciate you guys for spending the time in your day. I know we're all very busy here, and we'll see everybody on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Thank you.